Welcome to episode 123 of the Get Cyber Resilient Show. Today is our behind the news edition of the show. I'm Dan McDermott, your host, and I'm joined by our resident cybersecurity experts, Garrett O'Hara and Vin Yuan. Today, we will begin by looking into the proposal to institute a government-wide ban on Chinese-linked cameras. Next, we'll delve into the hottest topic in tech on the planet at the moment, ChatGPT, and its impact on cybersecurity. Our final deep dive story will be a review of a new industry group formed to boost national critical infrastructure resilience. And we'll end with a wrap of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. Gar and Vin, welcome back to the podcast. And as always, there's plenty of news headlines for us to look into. Gar, let's kick off with a look at how the topic of international surveillance has been making headlines all around the world. And last week, the Attorney General has sought advice on the government creating a ban on cameras made by Chinese manufacturers being used across many government departments.
Yeah, absolutely, Dan. I think we're basically just following the US and the UK on this one. And, we've sort of seen them, for all intents and purposes, kind of ban the use of any surveillance equipment from a couple of Chinese camera makers. And, I think we're basically, just following suit there. This is a really interesting one for many reasons. It points to the complexity of digital supply chain and where we get the goods that we use day to day for things like networking and surveillance, cameras, all the IP connected devices, so IoT devices, and kind of almost harks back to some of the conversations and comments that we've had from folks like Dmitry Alperovich a couple of years ago when he was on the pod and talking about the world of IoT and how that plays into federal organizations in the US and the vulnerabilities that that stem from that. Along similar lines, I suppose, what you're looking at here is potentially internet-connected devices produced by a country that isn't Australia. And I think that's the nuance here. I think we've got a placeholder in some ways for this story, which is in this case China, but it really could be any country where you're sourcing hardware from, including our friends in the US. They've got form here with some of the work they did with the NSA, and people may know at one point Cisco were shipping equipment to basically anonymized addresses because they were concerned about the NSA intercepting shipped cargo from Cisco to their customers, with the worry being that the NSA was going to sort of intercept them, add something to the devices to be able to intercept communication. So, this isn't an issue purely with our friends just to the north, but actually, it's a broader problem, I would say, for most countries going forward. I think it's a smart move, to be honest with you. It might be a little bit pessimistic and conservative and feel a bit scary, but surely this is, one of those things where if you kill the monster when it's small, make the decision now to get these kind of devices out of anywhere that they could pose a risk, then, later down the line, it's one less thing to worry about. I don't know about you guys, in reading some of the coverage of this stuff, there was... what seems to often happen with this stuff is, which it kind of becomes political very quickly, and there did seem to be a little bit of that going on. And I'm basing that not necessarily in what was said, but where it was said. And some of the coverage was, the more rattlesabery stuff was very much in the kind of media that you'd associate with kind of right wing and the hawkish type folks, the people who quite often their headlines are designed to scare the people who are sort of awake after a certain hour and watching certain channels, et cetera, how that works. But that's not to say it's not without absolute merit. And I think it's spot on to at least be asking the questions. And that's just good cyber, right? Understand what the problem is before you can actually do anything about it. And I think that's part of what, you certainly saw with the AG and that sort of seeking of answers, I should say, around... what is the scope of the presence when it comes to, in this case, Chinese equipment from Hikvision and Dahua? I'm probably saying those wrong, so my apologies to any native speakers of the language. That's my terrible, terrible attempt at saying those correctly. But it's one of those things, guys, that I think is spot on. It's the right move as far as kind of sovereign security. I'm sure if we had a magic wand, the world wouldn't be what the world is, but there is no nation on this planet, I suspect, that if they had the option to do this, wouldn't do it. I think every government is going to do that. And I mean, even Australia, right? We've been caught bugging other countries and stuff like that. So, you know, it's like no one should be surprised that that these questions are being asked. And hopefully there's, you know, some problems that could have happened in the future that are sort of headed off the pass.
Yeah, it's interesting that you sound, you know, very level-headed about it, but very much like you think this is a real thing. Like, it feels like it's, you know, back to, you know, the Cold War days, and it's more like in a movie script than actual reality of international surveillance. We've seen weather balloons being shot down around the world.
Weather balloons?
You think there is a legitimacy to the fear, or is it just fear mongering?
No, I mean, there's form here. This isn't, unfortunately, I wish it was, but it's not fear mongering. And there's been other instances. There's a company out of China, that's quite some time ago, where, was it Microserve? I've got the name wrong. It's quite a while, it's years ago, but there was a, call it a big, you know, big sort of expose where a particular, was it Microserve, maybe it was the server manufacturer, but anyway, out of China. And they found these chips on the motherboards, and those chips were being used in servers by organizations like Apple and AWS. And, you know, they were phoning home data. So, like, this is not a, of all the people, you know, I'd probably be throwing my tinfoil hat on here and kind of freaking out. But this is a real, you know, it's a real deal. We've got past experience or past examples where exactly this has happened. And like I say, I mean, this it's not just China. I mean, the NSA PRISM was basically a mass surveillance on sovereign citizens in the US. Actually, I don't think you can say sovereign citizen these days without having weird connotations. I don't mean it in anything other than people who are citizens of the United States being basically spied on by their own government. So I think it's an absolutely legitimate concern. And it's sort of like the other realities here. I think, you know, as tech people, we kind of think about, okay, well, what if there's a chip on the motherboard, or what if there's a backdoor in the BIOS, or, you know, those kind of sort of hacky version, hacky tech type things. But actually, when you think about it, I mean, a lot of the buying data surely would be very, very interesting to the CCP. So, you know, a particular organization is buying a particular type of server, and where are they being shipped to? You know, what's the demographics? What's the movement of materials, in a particular country? I mean, that's not for nothing either. That's going to be really useful information. So, and that's the reality. I mean, I think the other thing is, any organization where their headquarters are, or they're based out of CPO or China, to my knowledge, the CCP can basically tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, we need you to do X, Y, Z. We need this backdoor. We need this thing installed. We need access to the data. And I don't think Chinese organizations get to say no, right? You guys have sure seen the story of people, very, very, very wealthy people just vanishing for, you know, a month and coming back and saying they're sorry. And, you know, that's the world that sort of country operates in. And like, that's the reality. I think there's a game you can play when you're China, which is a long game, that if you're a sort of country where you've got democratically elected leaders that churn every 4 years and your organizations are kind of free enterprise and driven by capitalism, you've got a very different horizon when it comes to stuff like this. You know, you can do things today that you'll benefit from 10, 15 years from now. And I think that's the thing. We can't play that way. Put it this way, in China, I'm pretty sure if a terrorist organization did something and the CCP said to the equivalent of Apple, we need you to backdoor your encryption because we need to find out about the, you know, whatever the terrorist organization is, they would either say yes or they'd say no, and they'd end up disappeared for a month and then say yes. But either ways, they're going to say yes. So they're like very different operating environments. I think, like, it's like I say, this isn't a China problem. I would say Australia, every other country needs to be thinking about where it's sourcing materials, where it's sourcing tech from. And given how complex motherboards are, the technology that goes into those motherboards, networking gear, like, yeah, it's a huge, huge risk, I would say, globally.
The last time I remember something like this sort of making the headlines was, you know, in the lead up to preparing for 5G. and whether Huawei would be allowed to participate in the tender process and to actually be part of the equipment for the 5G sort of network rollouts across the country. Do you think this is a bit of an, like that was at a very large scale? Is this a bit of an extension of the same thinking, I guess at a more micro level?
I would say similar concerns for sure. And it's really hard to get away from it. If you're at that lower level in the tech stack, whatever you want to call it, OSM model, or, depending on how you want to look at the networking side of things, like the lower you go, like potentially the more you can see and the harder it is to know that your data is being kind of sideloaded somewhere, et cetera. So how difficult it would be to embed a particular manufacturer in your 5G network and then, afterwards realize actually there's a weird firmware thing that has just been uploaded that allows some functionality that we hadn't thought of and, exposes potentially like confidential comms or, metadata around what people are doing and who they're communicating with. Similar thing. I mean, it's not quite the same in terms of the scope of the problem. 5G is nationwide. Like it impacts everybody and everywhere. And it's not just, making phone calls, but it's, potentially data usage in lots of places. So, pretty huge concern to not have that fully locked down. And imagine if they'd got that wrong. Imagine 5 years in, 10 years in, after the huge expense of rolling out a 5G network nationally, and then somebody realizes, oh, this thing's happening that we probably didn't realize at the time when we bought this gear. Right thing to do, definitely 5G. This is clearly a smaller problem. Like if you're talking about IP connected surveillance cameras, things like that, they're used in particular locations, but it's not every single person that's going to be affected by it. But the risk is the same thing. It's supplier and digital supply chain risk. It's funny. This one has just sparked so many more questions than answers, I think, when it comes to this stuff, because I forget about the cyber side of things, but like the sort of economics of sourcing a lot of this tech, so many countries have just dropped their manufacturing ability and certainly their high-end manufacturing capabilities, and it's all moved to a certain couple of countries. I mean, you can't just kind of flip a switch and bring it all back. So, I don't know how that works. It's definitely... it's an interesting one. I'm glad to see there's a conversation happening in Australia. Clearly, it's already happened in the UK and the US and also Europe.
Indeed. Well, I do feel a little bit like I'm in Spies Like Us talking about this. I think that it's certainly gone to the extent of my knowledge on the topic, that's for sure.
Is that a Dan Aykroyd movie? Is it?
Chevy Chase.
Chevy Chase, there you go. Love Chevy Chase.
Vin, let's move to our next story, which is probably the hottest topic in tech right now, ChatGPT. What is its impact and similar AI tools' impact on the world of cybersecurity?
It's taken the world by storm, hasn't it, ChatGPT? And while we're on the topic, I will make a shout out for one of the articles that I posted on Get Cyber Resilient that does talk about GPT and I guess both sides of the table when it comes to, what CISOs are thinking, what threat actors are doing. But that's exactly what we're talking about today, right? And for those who haven't come across ChatGPT yet, developed by OpenAI, greatly impacted the field of natural language processing as we revolutionized the way the computers understand and generate human-like text. It's been integrated with various other platforms, including chatbots, customer service, and language translations, improving efficiency and user experience. Now, if you think that sounded a little bit odd, that wasn't actually me. That was actually me putting in a prompt to ChatGPT and kind of spat that out. So it is very convincing in terms of technology and what it sounds like to be human. And it's amazing to see the popularity it's actually attracted, not from just heavy tech users and cybersecurity professionals, but even look at just your general kind of person off the street that they've heard of it. It's easy to create a login, then start to kind of interface with this machine learning AI model in the background. Now, for cybersecurity folks specifically, we look at ChatGPT and we immediately, our minds go to cyber attacks straight away, right? And they've done their best in terms of putting in controls, things like content policy filters that will tell you to do things like, you can't make inappropriate requests or you can't create malware. But with some creativity as a prompt, you know, we've seen examples of this. You know, we've seen examples where it could be used for constructing, you know, social engineering type of phishing attacks. You know, you put in the right requests, it can actually go ahead and create Python scripts that go in and kind of grab your files. It's one of those things where ChatGPT can debug code, therefore you can probably ask it to do a few other clever things on the side as well. Now, it still means that, you know, at the end of the day, we still need to do our due diligence around security, like MFA, cybersecurity awareness training, that defends, I guess, the wider cybersecurity landscape than that ChatGPT machine learning AI does kind of fall into a little bit, but it's scary stuff, isn't it? You know, not just what's done with ChatGPT, but, you know, you look at the applications of AI machine learning in general, it's almost like a new world now.
Yeah, one of the ways that somebody described it to me was like, it's been a long time where, you know, you can create malware and deploy malware at scale and stuff. And there's been different ways of being able to do that and looking at creating the code, and even to the point of, you know, our good friends, our ransomware as a service gangs and all of these sort of things that can deploy it. I think one of the scary things is, like you say, is how real and how human the language sounds, and the ability to start to trick people and humans at scale to create things that actually sound far more believable in terms of some of the language used. And like you say, it's sort of going down that sort of impersonation and BEC sort of route in a way that, you know, is going to be much harder for people to detect on the other end of reading something.
And I think the key thing here is barrier of entry. Right, because if you think about machine learning AI, most people won't know where to start when it comes to that technology. But by interfacing with something that is just a text box and you put in a prompt and it gives you results, and if it's not the one that you want, you just re-enter the prompt again, you know, anyone can go ahead and then start to create really, you know, either cool things or very, you know, malicious things using technology like that.
The funny thing is, I heard this last week, but apparently the sort of GPT version this was released on is, I think, 3. They've actually got 4 at the moment. So they kind of went to market very quickly with ChatGPT, and there's actually another version coming out. So as good as it is now, it'll be interesting to see like what the next one looks like. And to riff on some what you said, Vin, like that you know, the safeguards that they've put in place to, you know, stop people kind of asking it to please write me a phishing email and the supporting malware, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it'll say no. I heard a really good analogy, and I'm stealing it from somebody, I cannot remember who it was, but it's sort of like you say, can you please make me a gun to a 3D printer? And it will say no. But you can say, print a barrel, yes. Print the handle, yes. Print the, you know, the magazine for the bullets, yes. Print the trigger, yes. And, you know, you can actually, very similarly with ChatGPT, it'll say no, and it kind of, when it's very obvious that you're doing the wrong thing. But from what I've read and some of the stuff I've heard, it's actually quite easy to ask the questions in a way that gets you to what you want, but without it being so overt. And I think that's kind of what's kind of scary. To your point, the barrier of entry, it's just dropped it again.
But really, it's much more like the IKEA version of creating malware. You still have to compile it yourself and build it together.
It comes with a Flatpak instruction, Dan. It's like, it's all you think of, like riffing on the IKEA thing. Like, you sort of learn a little bit about making furniture if you've done enough of the IKEA assembly. And not ChatGPT, but I'm thinking more and more around the positive side of AI and, you know, some of the promises of it interrogating data and doing the kind of grunt work that cyber analysts have had to do. And I think the same potentially applies in legal and some other areas. And I'm kind of thinking more and more, is it like the Karate Kid, you know, with the Daniel, and probably the first one, I don't know if it happens in Cobra Kai, but, you know, Daniel's son has to literally spend weeks and weeks doing wax on, wax off, and, you know, all that stuff, and it's super boring. And then, when it comes to the fight, he can do wax on, wax off, and he's able to, you know, block punches and all that stuff. And I'm kind of thinking more and more, is there something that we learn through the donkey work in some jobs where it's crap, it seems boring at the time, but your brain gets wired by the work to notice patterns or to think in a certain way. And I wonder on the cyber defense side, are we going to steal anything from the next wave of analysts who will be going in to, you know, do the job of sort of cybersecurity, but not really maybe fully understanding the data that's being presented to them? I remember, I'm going a little tangent here, probably 21, 22 years ago, sitting with a cousin who was in technology and kind of more on the hardware side of things. And he was actually commenting around the emergence of kind of higher level languages like C and even things like VB and stuff like that. And he was saying that it's actually really bad in a way because there's a generation of folks who are coming through who actually don't know what they're really doing. The language is taking care of so much for them. They're not able to understand what it means to move things between different memory registers and like the actual complexity of programming a chip. It's all taken care of at a layer, subtracted and taken care of at a layer higher. And I always remember that because I think there's an element to that maybe is happening in AI where it is not quite the same thing to troll through a bunch of logs and do the brain work to understand what a pattern is and, you know, what it looks like and what is truly something you need to chase or pay attention to. But if you just kind of go, hey, ChatGPT, is this dangerous? And it says yes, I think you've stolen a lot of the foundational knowledge. I'm saying that I've never worked in a SOC, so, you know, people who work in a SOC are probably listening to me going, what a Muppet. He's got that completely wrong and nobody ever wants to go through the hell that is, threat hunting.
But you're right. The whole thing about AI is about doing sort of, like you say, that notion of grunt work at scale and that. And then for humans to be able to layer on intelligence over the top. But you need a foundation to do that, right? To have that extra level of thinking and intelligence added on top of. So interesting sort of way to think about whether, you know, is it not allowing us to actually evolve and get to the spot that we need to in terms of the roles that we would play as well. Certainly going to be a challenge, not just in cyber, but in so many industries and for so many people as we go forward through this. You know, it is going to be a revolution. I don't think there's any doubting that.
It's already started, right? I mean, you think about sort of DALL-E and the graphic stuff. I think of WALL-E, the sort of film, because I just have visions of us all in cyber kind of floating around on, you know, hover stretchers with, I don't know, sodas being fed into us and not having to do any thinking or exercise. Like, we need to, be mindful of that stuff.
Indeed. Well, we've managed two 1980s film references so far, in one episode, so I think we're going pretty well. Let's dive into the final deep dive story for this episode and have a look at a new industry group that's being formed to boost critical infrastructure resilience. Gar, how will this new group assist?
It's an ISAC for the critical infrastructure industry, which is pretty kind of nice to see. So obviously, ISACs exist as a thing in cyber where you get an industry type or whatever will come together and kind of share information and analysis between them. So you see them kind of around the world, actually. So seeing the kind of critical infrastructure industry organizations come together to create an ISAC, I think is important. So apparently there's 11,000 organizations that will be covered across the 11 sort of sectors within CI or CNI. And I think there's some good stuff in this, Dan. Obviously, we've talked about CNI quite a lot, actually, in the podcasts and roundtables and lunches and all of those conversations we've had with folks in CNI and cyber in general. But I wonder, as part of this, like the that is a sector getting ahead of any potential increase in regulation. So, you know, let's all start getting ahead of it and sharing information and doing the best we can to get ahead of these issues. I mean, this is the problem for pretty much every country. So I wonder, will we get to the point where, you know, we've got a national CI ISAC, but I wonder, will you start to see a global, like a GCI ISAC? I should trademark the domain for that just in case and make some mad coin. But you kind of wonder, will it get to that point? And certainly with things like Five Eyes or AUKUS, I mean, it presumably would make sense. The things that are going to happen to attack CNI here can't be that dissimilar with nuance between different countries. So, it probably happens at some level anyway, but, you know, making a more formal industry body is probably a good thing. I think it sounds really positive in a number of ways. One of them being that it's designed to protect all of the organizations, including the small ones, which I know is something that's very close to your heart when it comes to cyber, in that it isn't just, you know, for the bigger organizations or lots of people and potentially deeper pockets, but actually It's designed to scale up and scale down the pricing to cater for smaller organizations that maybe don't have, you know, fully developed or fully matured or big budgets for stuff like this. So, you know, it'll kind of take that into account. And again, I think that's something that benefits everybody in CNI because they're often customers of each other. So, you know, it's a sort of micro version of a macro problem that you and I and others have spoken about at length over the last few years. You know, the SMB in Australia being another example. But yeah, a positive move. I think it's a good news story. Great to see some proactive moves by the CNI industry and look forward to seeing what comes from it.
Yeah, indeed. As you say, I think one of the challenges with CNI has been like, you know, who does it impact? And then understanding like, okay, what does that mean from a supply chain point of view? You know, like if you're a small organization, maybe you don't fall into it exactly, but if you're part of a supply chain, what's the flow-on impact to you? So an industry group to actually help assist throughout that and all of those organizations. As you say, I'm sure the top end of town are get their house in order pretty quickly, put the money behind it, the resources. But, you know, there's still a long way to go for everybody across who's impacted by CNI to actually be get their house in order, so to speak, and be, you know, able to meet obligations that may not fall directly on them, but fall part of, you know, who they support and supply as part of that overall supply chain for us as well.
Definitely.
Terrific. Well, finally, let's wrap up with a quick review of the latest breaches of vulnerabilities to make the headlines. The first news item is one that may have come up a little bit earlier in the show around the government banning TikTok from work phones.
Yeah, like it is so funny, isn't it? Because, you know, we just talked about the surveillance and, you know, chips and hardware and backdoors and all that stuff. And then, you know, people are walking around with their work phones and TikTok installed, which, you know, falls under the same kind of set of problems. Obviously, Tencent, I mean, this hit when Trump was in, right? I mean, the whole debacle where it was Microsoft going to buy it and then, you know, it was the weird kind of deal with Oracle and the massive amount of work that has sort of been attempted in the background to kind of extricate the US citizens' data from the rest of the data. And I believe in Tencent's headquarters, I don't know where they are, I presume California somewhere, they've actually got a locked room which only folks from the US government can go into, and they can like look at the code to, you know, make sure that there's nothing nefarious happening with TikTok, apparently. Heard that on a podcast recently. the host was getting a tour of the place, so that sounded pretty interesting to me. Anyway, I guess the point is, what I've heard TikTok described as, apart from the potential of the vacuuming of data from a device, if it's installed on there and potentially the permissions have been gotten wrong, you know, that's obviously one concern. But the bigger concern actually that's been talked about more and more, I think certainly in the US and I think to a lesser extent in Australia so far, but I'm sure that will change, but it's the kind of influence attacks and, you know, some of the things we've actually talked about on the podcast in previous episodes. You know, when you look at the kind of militarization of technology, something like TikTok, forget about stealing data, but as an influencing mechanism where, you know, if you're in the CCP and you want to get something across for a particular candidate in an Australian election, like, do you sort of promote content that, you know, either makes them look better or worse or whatever, but you can start to, I've heard it described as you know, putting the finger on the scale. So, you know, you're slightly going to get things veering in a certain direction. It falls under that banner, I suspect. But anyway, again, you know, this is the world we live in. And I think it's a positive move. And I think you're probably going to see much more aggressive approaches to TikTok going forward, certainly like for work devices, government devices. But I'm starting to wonder, and then, you know, not because I'm some genius, but I listen to enough podcasts, so they talk about the potential regulation of stuff like TikTok in the US. Because again, you've got Tencent, an organization based out of CPOR, where if the CCP came to them and said, hey, we want you to do XYZ right now, I believe they would have to do that. So like it's sort of a really interesting one when it's I've got friends who are like addicted to TikTok. I've never been on it, by the way. I don't know if you guys have, but I've never gone on there because I'm afraid it's like crack, apparently. Once you go on, you never get off.
I was just about to say, I'm still enjoying following you on TikTok, and then you've ruined that by saying you've never been on there.
Yeah, everybody who has described it just said it's like crack. It's astonishingly good at picking the stuff that's, you know, going to keep you hooked on there, whatever your thing happens to be. So yeah, it's kind of a scary one.
Yeah, I downloaded it just to kind of see what it was all about. It was only just to see what it looked like, and then an hour later I looked up. I was like, this has to go. Now I had to get rid of TikTok. It's consuming my life.
Yeah, I just see my 15-year-old glued to it, so it's doing something. I don't know what. I can't follow. So, well, from TikTok, we'll go back to the, I guess, local story around the continued fallout from the Medibank breach, this time with the insurer now declaring that they will defend themselves against class action lawsuits. Finn, what's the latest here?
So it's, I think a week ago, it was a class action brought forward by Omni Bridgeway and Baker McKenzie. And to your point, Dan, it was in response to kind of what we've been following along in the local story with Medibank. You know, there's attributions to the Russian-based Revel, extortion as a service gang, and evidently the leakage of PII. And then we then followed the story about Medibank didn't then pay the ransom, and it was dripped slowly out onto the dark web. But really, you know, for, I guess, these law firms to come up and say, you know, hey, there's a statement that, you know, we will contest allegations of breach of contract, contravention of Australian consumer law and all this other stuff as well, very big lawyer terms. But I guess Medibank off the back of that have come out saying, hey, we will actually defend against this class action. I believe it's different from the class action that we've spoken about previously. I think it was Maurice Blackburn lawyers, his tenure lawyers. I think that OIC had their own investigation going along as well. But I think the main takeaway from this is, you know, a lot of organizations will be looking to see what happens, right? A sign for other organizations to look at their corporate security strategy and their standards and saying, like, if this could happen to Medibank, this could happen to us as well. And to see the fallout from this, it will be very interesting as time ticks along.
Indeed. It's a story that just keeps delivering, right? And there's always keeps happening as the next evolution of what's happening with that. And we'll continue to keep an eye on that. Finally, the Commonwealth Bank have launched a system to tackle email scams. Gar, how will this help to help protect consumers?
Can we do Foley sounds, Dan? Is there any way you could do like a round of applause and, you know, an audience clapping? Because right now would be the time to do that. If the edit can, if we can do that in the edit, that would be amazing. Look, this is great, right? This is the sort of stuff that you and I and Vin have talked about, I think, many times. You know, the sort of banking industry and some of the stuff where you kind of scratch your head and wonder, why don't we do that? And in this one, when you put in the BSP and account number, it's going to show you the name of the accounts. For a transfer that you're going to do. So when you think BEC, that becomes really useful. So you get an email purportedly from maybe somebody who's built cabinets in your home, like a guest of ours, Laura. I can't remember the episode number off the top of my head, but I'm sure we can include it in the show notes, where significant amount of money taken from your account, because when you put in the BSP and the account number, there's no kind of cross-check that they're correct. And with this, you put in what you think is Bob the Builder's cabinet making PTY LTD. And when you put in the BSP and account number and it says, you know, I'm going to steal your money, PTY LTD, cool. Like, at least it gives you a little bit of a signal that your money's coming to the wrong place. Foley sound for yay, round of applause. Really, look, and here's the thing. Such seems like such a small thing, but I reckon, I'm not a gambling man, but if I was, I'd put good money on this being something that will actually have a significant impact in terms of that kind of BEC, and certainly in some industries like real estate, we've talked about a bunch of times, and the construction industry, this is going to help, I think.
Indeed. And so it was Laura Jeffrey's episode that you were referring to there in terms of personal impact of BEC and what it can mean on any person and then the impact to them. Well, thank you, Gar and Vin. Appreciate your insights in another big news episode today. Gar, who do you have as our special guest for next week?
Very lucky, actually, to have David Higgins from, he's had a few different roles. He's obviously a cybersecurity leader and probably very well known to our friends over in New Zealand. He was the CISO and head of technology operation, risk and compliance over at Kiwi Bank. And actually saw him, Vin and myself. Vin was like a celebrity at CyberCon in New Zealand. And the only person second to the attention was David. Obviously, he gave an incredibly good talk at CyberSecCon. And as a result of that, I kind of reached out and just said, hey, like what you said, really digged it. And any chance you can jump on the pod. So he's going to join us. We're actually going to talk about ChatGPT, surprisingly. I think that's the kind of hot topic at the moment. But David's obviously got a very strong perspective, and something he talked about at CyberSecCon was around the people side of cyber. And he's very, very kind of passionate around that as a topic, as I know we as a group are too. So I think he's a perfect guest for us.
Terrific. Looking forward to that indeed. Until next week, if you'd like to continue exploring key topics in cybersecurity, please jump onto getcyberresilience.com and check out some of the latest articles, including Vin's latest on how ChatGPT is changing the game for hackers and CISOs, and how to test your code before a criminal does. Thanks for listening, and if you'd like to join us live at Mimecast Connect in late February, just search Mimecast APAC Connect and register now. Until next time, stay safe.